Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program as always. And today we've got a great post-debate program for you. We'll be diving into the first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. A lot of thoughts there, and we'll get into those in just a moment. But I'm holding in my hands, hot off the presses, the latest edition of NC Capital Connection. And in big, bold headlines, across the top, it says, taxes down, North Carolina thrives. And this is an article by Brian Balfour. As you know, the executive vice president of the Civitas Institute. We had Brian on last week talking about this very topic because it seems like at the beach where the waves just keep coming, the waves of good news in North Carolina's economy continue to come. And it's really, really exciting. And I hope that you'll get a copy of NC Capital Connection and read this excellent work by Brian Balfour. And just a truthful narrative about all of the good things that are going on in North Carolina. Big picture right in the middle of it says 300,000 new jobs and counting. And the caption says Governor Pat McCrory has recently noted that since 2013, North Carolina has one of the fastest growing economies in the nation. Unemployment is at an 8-year low, and more than 300,000 jobs have been added. Now, this is not spin. This is the good thing about this type of story, is that it's just a recitation of the facts. And it's not like, you know, you often hear from the left, oh, teachers are leaving in droves, and there's really no facts to support that. But these are facts. North Carolina's economy is doing very, very well in just multiple measures. The unemployment rate down, lower than the national average, hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Taxes have been cut here in North Carolina, which will help to fuel this economic, I don't even call it a recovery. It's a hot streak, and it's really amazing. So I would encourage you to get a copy of NC Capital Connection. You can do that at a variety of places, but it's really, really an excellent article. And then below the fold, the truth on school spending and teacher pay. Great work by Bob Lupke, the education policy analyst at the Civitas Institute. Average Wake County teacher pay over $53,000 per year. And again, here's another thing that we often hear the left, this monotone drumbeat about how poorly teachers are being paid and how, you know, those mean old Republicans in the Senate and the House who have the majority, they're cutting education and schools are on the verge of closing all across North Carolina. It's a wonder that there is a single bus on the highway, because if you listen to the narrative drone on from the left, education is being skewered and dismantled, and the traditional public school system, you know, will soon be non-existent in North Carolina. And nothing could be further from the truth. The facts often get drowned out by the loud voices of the left, and people are sitting around. Your average citizen may not know what to believe, but I encourage you folks to really get a hold of this thing for yourself and make yourself informed and, as a result, conversational about the truth in education in North Carolina, about the truth in the meteoric rise from what was proverbial ashes of economic disaster that was the North Carolina budget and the North Carolina state of the economy at the end of 2010. You know, it's easy to forget sometimes when we are so focused on what's in front of us, just how bad things were in our state not that long ago. And if you've listened to What Matters in North Carolina, I know that you've heard me say this before. Maybe you're getting tired of hearing it, but it's a fact that bears repeating, and one that you should have at the ready when you're talking about the differences between a conservative leadership, a conservative majority in the North Carolina General Assembly and in the governor's office, as opposed to a left-leaning liberal majority that we had as recently as at the end of 2010, 100 years of liberal leading. And the left would say, oh, North Carolina is so progressive and nationally known for its education. Well, the majority up until 2010 was the Democratic Party. And again, not being partisan, I'm just laying out the facts for you here. They cut education. They froze teacher pay. And, oh, if you get on social media, they are the standard bearers for education and for teacher pay. And nothing could be further from the truth. They froze teacher pay. They cut education spending, raised taxes. And when they were no longer in the majority, they left behind a budget deficit of nearly $3 billion. Now, how would you like to sit down with your checkbook and your copy of whatever financial software you use, and at the beginning of the year, you are down, say, $30,000? It would take a while to make that difference up. And this is what the Republican majority in January of 2011 were faced with on a much grander scale. $3 billion in the hole, deficit, short, in the red. But they did not shirk away. They didn't back down. They didn't flounder with butterflies in their stomach. Oh my, what are we going to do? The previous majority also left behind a state health plan that was in disarray. And I remember because I was working in the North Carolina Senate at that time, and we would receive reams of email about the state health plan from people concerned and upset. And so the new majority had to deal with that. The unemployment division, former director Dale Falwell says that when he arrived, it was broke and broken. North Carolina owed the federal government $2.5 billion. So the Republican majority, what did they do? They went to work. And lo and behold, they cut taxes. What? Are you kidding me, Mark? They cut taxes? Seems like you would have had to raise taxes just to try to make up the budget deficit. No. They made up the budget deficit. They fixed the state health plan. They paid off the federal government $2.5 billion. They have also set aside over $1 billion in the unemployment insurance trust fund. They have increased the state's rainy day fund exponentially from what it was when the Democrats were in charge. All of this by doing common sense things. Hold the line on spending and begin to implement tax reforms for the middle class in North Carolina. It's really not complicated. It's not complex. And yet the left, they want so much to get the reins of control back in the General Assembly. Why? So they can expand their control, their government intrusion into our lives. The Republican majority has cut numerous regulations that were anti-business and that were choking the ability of small businesses to make a profit in North Carolina. Well, when you get those regulations, those unnecessary, onerous government regulations off of the back of small business, what can they do? They can conduct business, they can make a profit, they can hire new employees, and the wheel goes round and round. And it's amazing to me because North Carolina has a very highly educated population, and yet there are still people in the state that would love to go back to having a leftist majority in the General Assembly. I don't know if these people have some type of fetish that says, please take my paycheck in greater volume. Let me pay higher taxes. Let me be burdened with more regulation. It's an ideology that says government knows best. Well, the conservative ideology says that people know best, that people know best how to spend their money, and that there is an unlimited pool of potential across our state that is represented by our citizens. And rather than have the government put the manacles of regulation and the choke chain of taxes on our people and on our businesses, the conservative ideology says, let's let people try to reach their potential. Let's get government out of the way. Let's unburden them from paying higher taxes. And look what happened, folks. Taxes are down, and yet North Carolina is thriving. Now, you and I both know that economies are cyclical, and there will be a time when things cool off. It's the nature of economics. Very simply, I could explain it to you this way. It's all about supply and demand. If there is a demand for something, people will want it. They will buy it. The producers will then be in a place where they have to produce more of it. And the prices are affected by this great demand. They will go up. Businesses will begin to hire more people to produce whatever it is that the public is demanding. Well, eventually that will wane and the cycle will begin to cool off and there won't be as much of the product made and perhaps there won't be as many employees needed and prices will go down because demand has dropped. Economies go in cycles and my example may have been, you know, about one product, but it's a grand conglomeration of businesses and services that all fall into the very simple idea of supply and demand, reality, the simple reality of supply and demand. And so economies cool off, and North Carolina's economy at some point will begin to cool off. And what will happen? Well, economies are known to go through ups and downs, and sometimes they go into a recessionary period. We saw that in the United States and here in North Carolina in around 2008. And the left would like to blame that for all of their mishandling of the state's finances, their mismanagement of the state's finances. But you see, the conservative majority, the Republicans who have been in the majority in the North Carolina General Assembly, are preparing. There's money in the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, and there's money in the state's Rainy Day Fund. So being prepared is a key element of good government, governing wisely. And folks like Senator Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore, they understand the cyclical nature of economies, and they're preparing for the time when things will cool down here in North Carolina. But for the moment, we are enjoying one of the most fantastic hot streaks economically in the history of the state. And so this is the narrative that you need to begin to tell your friends and family, because oddly enough, there are people that are just chomping at the bit, wanting the left to be in charge again. Hey, you know, they might cut teacher pay again if they get back in charge. Look at the truth, folks. The truth is on your side. The General Assembly has raised teacher pay. Average teacher pay in North Carolina will be $50,000 per year based on the most recent budget and teacher pay increases that were allocated and appropriated for. Teachers are not leaving the state to go elsewhere in droves. Get the truth on your side and be able to give people the facts. A lot of time the truth, you know, people are going to believe what they believe. But when you can tell somebody, hey, look, here's a state budget, and you see these numbers at the bottom that say K through 12, and you see how they go up every year? That right there just disarms and diffuses the argument that those mean old Republicans are cutting education spending. So I encourage you to read publications like NC Capital Connection. Go to nccivitas.org. Read there. some of the great work that is put up on a daily basis about our economy and other policy matters, and listen to What Matters in North Carolina, and get your friends and family to listen. Because knowing the truth is crucial, particularly with 6 weeks left before the upcoming election. And you will be bombarded with commercials that lie and tell you that, you know, Governor McCrory has cut education spending, jobs are leaving. And when you know the truth, you can tell the truth to people around you. And it's very, very important that people know what a phenomenal job is being done in North Carolina as related to the economy, as relates to teacher pay. And it goes on and on and on. Corning Optical yesterday adding more jobs here in North Carolina. So tell your friends, go to the iTunes store, sign up to have What Matters in North Carolina as part of your daily podcast. Google Play Store, you'll find us there. And give out the website, freedomactionnetwork.com. You can listen to What Matters in North Carolina anytime and be informed and be armed with the truth. You can follow us on Twitter also at What Matters NC. You can hit me up at Mark Shiver. And we have a couple of great guests for you today. We'll be talking with Dr. David McLennan from Meredith College about the debate last night, and also one of my favorite guests, John Gibbs. He is an African-American. He is a commentator. He is very, very, very articulate and will bring you insight into some of the challenges that we've seen in Charlotte and nationally in the African-American community. And we'll also get his perspective on last night's debate. You can read his work at thefederalist.com. Thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Well, it's always a pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, Dr. David McLennan. He is professor of political science at Meredith College. Good morning, Dr. McLennan. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and particularly after a big event like last night.
Well, certainly was the biggest event so far in this presidential campaign, and wanted to get your initial reaction and your thoughts.
Well, a couple different thoughts. First, it's worth reminding our listeners that this is not academic debate that we're talking about. If this were Oxford University debating, we'd have a clear-cut winner. But this isn't. This is political debate, and this is political debate in 2016. So I think my overall impressions were that both candidates probably addressed their respective bases pretty well. Donald Trump did a great job, particularly early on, sort of stressing the basic message he's been stressing all along, that he is the outsider candidate, Hillary Clinton's the experienced insider, and really playing up on economic issues to the dissatisfaction in the country. On the flip side, I think Hillary Clinton showed toward the end of the debate a little bit more knowledge of foreign affairs, nuclear policy, and those kind of things. But again, all in all, we may not see this debate as necessarily moving numbers significantly. There may be some people in the middle, in the undecided category, of which there are about 20%, that may make decisions based on this debate. But this is Donald Trump was Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton was Hillary Clinton.
Well, Dr. McLennan, a couple of things from a practical nature. First of all, I thought it interesting that when they showed the split screen, it actually looked as if she were a hair taller than him. Of course, he's almost, in reality, a foot taller than her. And so I think that was very helpful for her from a visual perspective. Secondly, gee whiz, could he have taken some type of sinus medicine? I mean, he must have sniffed about 13,000 times. And those are little things that, you know, thinking back to how Nixon lost to Kennedy because he was sick and didn't look well, those are little things that can hurt a candidate.
You know, the optics are important, and the style is very important, as you said. I mean, people are watching for those things as much as they're listening for the ideas. You know, the reality is, you know, I've seen things online that he's coming down with a cold, and, you know, I guess it was a decision made by the campaign team that, you know, to take something for it may have been more problematic than the sniffling. Yeah, it was an issue. You know, the split screen does kind of point out the differences between the candidates in terms of facial expressions, that sort of thing. But, you know, let's kind of remind everybody, we're talking about 90 minutes on your feet with 100 million pairs of eyeballs on you for a 68 and a 70-year-old. And so, you know, yeah, we can pick apart their individual performances, and we might do that. But let's just kind of put it in perspective that, you know, this is not the easiest task in the world, and I'm not dismissing, you know, anything about either candidate, but just saying, you know, those things matter, as you suggested, but let's kind of keep it in perspective. This is not a Hollywood-produced movie.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I agree with you. I would think that my initial reaction, and tell me if you felt the same way, she seemed much better prepared, and obviously she has gotten off of the campaign trail to prepare, and I think that came through last night. It seemed like she... you know, we don't know if she had an earpiece in and somebody was whispering in her ear, but all joking aside, I felt like she was much better prepared.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear, and the Trump people even admitted going into the debate that Trump had not spent as much time, you know, becoming expert in policy. She's a policy person. He's a big idea person. And so you did see those differences come out pretty clearly. But again, if we kind of go back to what does all this mean, you know, the Clinton people are going to say, you know, she was much more expert on foreign and domestic policy, and the Trump people are going to say, yeah, he may have missed some of the details, but the larger issue of saying, you know, we have economic issues and other issues that we need to deal with different people in Washington, you know, that's going to resonate with them. I think the real question to me is, we know that the outcome of this debate is going to depend on a couple key demographic groups, college-educated women and minorities. Did either candidate move those numbers on with their performance last night? We'll have to see in the next couple of days.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen some of the, and our guest, by the way, Dr. David McLennan, excellent professor of political science at Meredith College, and always tremendous insight on all things having to do with politics and elections and campaigning and voting behavior. But I've seen some post-debate polling kind of all over the place. Some say, you know, 50-50. Some have him winning. Some have her winning. I'm curious, though, you talked about this demographic. She pretty well already can take for granted that the African-American vote is going to support her, even though I find it really fascinating that I don't remember ever a Republican candidate being as candid with the African-American community as Trump has been. In Detroit, he said, you know, what have you got to lose by voting for him and for a Republican, intimating that, you know, they've gotten nowhere over the last, you know, 60 years by continuing to vote for Democrats. What do you make of his attempt to try to siphon off some of the of that demographic?
Well, again, I think your point about siphoning off is really key. No one expects Donald Trump to win the African-American vote. But, you know, let's look at 2 or 3 months ago when he was virtually in low single digits. He was actually in low single digits in places like Ohio and things like that. He's gotten his support up into double digits now. You know, if he can somehow get upper teens to 20% of the African-American community to vote for him, which, you know, for some seems inconceivable, but again, it's not inconceivable, then that makes it very difficult for Hillary Clinton. So, you know, we're not talking about, you know, a majority of that constituency, but, you know, it's an interesting strategy to kind of say, you know, why not me? You've tried the other brand for this long, why not take a chance? And for people who are, you know, dissatisfied, and, you know, you look at polls and African Americans are just as dissatisfied with the direction of the country as are other groups in the country, you know, that might be a message that for some folks resonates.
Dr. McLennan, in terms of public perception, do you think this debate significantly impacted that group of voters that is oh so important, the unaffiliateds? maybe a little early to see some data, polling data specifically targeted towards them. But how do you think each candidate did in trying to woo the undecided, the unaffiliated, the independent that everyone's counting on to help them win?
Well, I think you're going to, as you suggested, we're going to have to wait a few days, because not only research tells us that the performance matters in the debate, but also the post-debate spin also matters. So we're going to see a lot of interpretation over the next, you know, 3 or 4 days. That factors into people's decision-making. And so, you know, I think by the end of the week, you know, we start seeing polls, and we're going to start seeing, you know, just overall polls and then looking at it by demographic group. You know, it may be too early to tell, but also let's keep in mind that we've got two other presidential debates coming up in October, and if we remember 4 years ago, Barack Obama had a pretty poor performance against Mitt Romney in the first debate, and he stepped up his game and did a little bit better in the second and third debate, and we know the outcome of the election. So no matter what we say about Donald Trump's performance and did he reach the right audience with the right message, or Mrs. Clinton, got to realize it's not a one and done. We've got two more debates, and I think, you know, for those undecided voters, I'm not sure we're going to see huge changes simply based on one debate performance.
Right.
Because they're going to say, well, both kind of did what we expected. Let's look down the road to second and third debate.
Here's something that I was surprised about. Let me get your take. Yesterday, in advance of the debate, I was throwing the question out there, who are we going to see? You know, the showman, the brash, bravado, insulting, or are we going to see someone a bit more key when it comes to low key when it comes to Donald Trump? I thought that he went out of his way last night, particularly at the end, to not be insulting, to not be, you know, engaging in really outright personal attacks. Hillary, on the other hand, you know, didn't seem to display any kind of reservation in that at all, talking about his business and how, you know, she's glad her father never worked for him. And what do you make of Trump, you know, kind of holding it back a little bit? Because there were certainly opportunities that he could have been much more aggressive in that regard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's probably a strong, good tactical move on his part. He was restrained in terms of, like you said, his last line about, you know, and we all know what he was alluding to, the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton, or Bill Clinton's other affairs.
Right.
You know, that certainly was where he could have gone. But in some ways, you know, he missed some opportunities. I mean, he raised the question of the emails and then never followed up on it. And, you know, we all know Mrs. Clinton's problems with trustworthiness stem to some degree from the emails. And so I think restraint is good in some regard, but I think as, you know, the Kellyanne Conway and the team decide to prep Donald Trump for debates 2 and 3, they're going to say, you know, restraint on some issues, you know, is not going to be all that good. I mean, you've got to remind people that Hillary Clinton does have an email issue, and it's part of a larger problem that she has with trustworthiness. So, you know, again, I think it's a mixed bag in terms of restraint.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was fascinating. And I sort of think, just, you know, my opinion, with a couple of bucks will get you coffee. But I think that before it's all done, I think he's going to really have to be more aggressive in these areas, because I don't think that nice Donald is really going to, you know, get him the ultimate points that he needs as far as debate performance. But it's really, and I don't mean to hammer this or stay on this topic too long, but it's really kind of a delicate balance there, because, you know, she is a female, and so you don't want to come across as, you know, this big bully. And so I would imagine that behind the scenes in the Trump campaign, there's been some, you know, vigorous back and forth between those who want him to, you know, go for the jugular, so to speak, and those who say, you know, you better be careful and not do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, particularly given what we talked about earlier, which is, we know that college-educated women are going to be a key constituent group. You know, that's why I think, he, you know, early in the debate, he talked about, you know, her 26 or 30-year experience in Washington and how, you know, unsuccessful she has been on a number of issues. and how the economy is being affected by the decisions made by her support of, or her husband's support of, trade policies. I think those are entirely appropriate, and I think those can help him win points, you know, to really position her as the insider who doesn't support programs that help people.
Right.
You know, but you're exactly right. Once he goes over the line and starts making it personal, you know, it may not be, you know, it may help his base and may fire them up because they don't like Hillary to begin with. But on the other hand, the groups he's trying to reach, that's a difficult one for him to cross.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. And this is a campaign unlike any other, I think, that we've seen, at least in my memory. And I'm sure that, you know, if we go back to the entire history of presidential campaigns, there's certainly been drama and, you know, anecdotes that can be shared. But this is really, really something else. The way that he got to where he is now, and even her primary battles with Bernie Sanders were very intriguing. So if I could shift gears for a moment, you know, I'm like the guy in the drive-thru who at the last minute wants to get that apple pie. So I just wanted to ask you a quick question while I've got you about North Carolina. It's intriguing to me that there have been four polls released in the last week or so. Civitas, Elon, and one other had Meredith College, which was came out yesterday, showed Governor McCrory up by a couple of points. And then High Point University rolls out theirs yesterday and shows that McCrory is down, you know, 6, 7, 8 points. So, you know, when you've got three that say, you know, pretty much the same thing, and then you've got another one that deviates from that trend, is what does that say? Are polls just, you know, unreliable to begin with, or is there a method difference that you can look at? Or how would you look at that disparity between three polls and then one?
Well, as a disclaimer, I did the Meredith poll, so
okay.
I'll just say that for your listeners that, you know, and this is why, again, as I tell my students, I would tell your listeners, you know, any individual poll is simply a snapshot in time of a subject pool.
Right.
You know, everybody from Nate Silver to academics to others say, you know, average them. So, you know, if you look at some of the polls, you're right. McCrory up, other polls have Cooper up. Our poll suggested, as others did, that we're going to have three very tight races. I'm talking about the presidential race, the governor's race, and the Senate race in North Carolina. They're all within the margin of error, which means, just without getting too wonky on you, you know, as you well know, that means that we're 95% sure that our poll is accurate at this time, but there is that outside chance that because of sampling error and things like that, you know, it may be that Cooper's up in our poll. So, you know, again, I'm not – there are methodological differences, differences in terms of who you predict will vote. That's the key difference between polls, is what model do you use to call your voters to say this is going to be what the 2016 electorate is going to look like. I suspect that's the difference, that High Point used a slightly different model of the electorate than did the other three.
And as far as debates go, while we're on that topic, here in North Carolina, interesting to me, Lieutenant Governor Forrest and his Democrat opponent, Linda Coleman, they've had a couple of debates now, and I don't think anybody knew about it except for the people in attendance and the candidates. The under the radar of some of these debates is, to me, is really remarkable, and it's almost like, why are they even going through the motions except perhaps for, you know, fodder for advertising or whatever. To me, that points to the reality that these down-ballot races, Dr. McLennan, are really going to have a hard time getting any kind of attention, you know, on a broad basis, because the presidential campaign and the governor's race are so dominant right now in terms of people's attention.
Yeah, I mean, even the U.S. Senate race in North Carolina is remarkably under the radar. And so if you go down ballot, the Council of State or the legislative races and other races in North Carolina, they are struggling to get attention. And, you know, as I tell my students, you know, somebody locally is going to affect your life a lot more than the President of the United States. So you really ought to pay attention to your legislative races, your county commissioner races, and that sort of thing. But that's kind of, you know, wasted breath on my part. You know, it is. I mean, particularly this year when we have such attention on the presidential race, and, you know, there's a Council of State debate tonight between the treasurer candidates, and, you know, your general point is a good one in that, you know, friends and family will watch and some political insiders, but will it really reach out to voters who really couldn't tell you who either candidate is? They're the people who need to watch it, but they're the people who probably won't watch it.
Yeah. Well, certainly we know that you'll be watching, and we will be pleased to be able to chat with you in the near future again, as this it's just getting closer, Dr. McLennan, and it's all going to be over in about
6 weeks.
Yeah, so that's pretty amazing. But thank you for your time this morning and for your excellent input. We always appreciate it, and thank you for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
It's always great to talk with you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
There is liberty in beer. Finally, a show that ties economics, philosophy, and regulations with the brewing industry. You would be surprised at how laws affecting the craft beer industry have huge effects all over North Carolina. Join the Free to Brew Show Saturdays at 1 p.m. with me, your host, Greg Polscher, where we dive into topics on distribution, ABC sales, federal and state laws, and even beer sports all over your favorite pint of beer. Find out how this seemingly progressive idea is dependent upon the ideas of liberty, capitalism, and property rights to ensure its survival and longevity. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Free to Brew NC. You can't have beer without liberty, and you can't have liberty without beer.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, John Gibbs. He is a political commentator and a contributor to The Federalist. He is also an African-American with a unique perspective. I say unique, unfortunately, because it's a perspective that hopefully more will begin to share as the word gets out that Mr. Gibbs has really got a phenomenal perspective on the African-American community. And so here with us to share that perspective as well as his thoughts on the debate last night is John Gibbs. Welcome to the program, sir.
Mark, thanks for having me again.
You know, I hate to call attention and say, you know, African-American political commentator, but I think that's important because the things that you have written and the things that you have said speak directly to the African-American community in a voice that, if it were heard, would exponentially impact that particular part of the American community that really needs the kind of input that you have.
Yeah, you know, I just try to speak the truth. I feel we have a lot of misinformation out there from the media, even the education system, and it tells black kids black underachievement is a fault of racism. It's a fault of slavery. It's a fault of segregation. So don't worry about it because you're not responsible for where you are in life. It's all someone else's fault. It's all because of racism. And you take away the power of someone to increase their own circumstances when you blame everything on stuff that happened 200 years ago or 50 or 60 years ago. And it's really destructive. I feel there's not enough black leaders especially that are telling this, and especially President Obama, who is at the forefront of those who are trying to blame racism, blame the police, blame anything and everything except going to black people and saying, we have a problem, let's get better.
Well, I know, John, that you watched the debate, as did I last night, and I'm going to tell you what I thought and then see if you share any of those observations. I felt like Hillary was much better prepared from the standpoint of being able to recite her talking points. I felt like the moderator, I was just reading an article where Lester Holt interrupted Donald Trump 41 times. I feel like that there was a great amount of bias displayed on the part of Lester Holt. But to the issue at hand, I don't think that Trump was as prepared as he possibly should have been. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I strongly agree with that. Donald Trump is not a talker and a debater. He's a doer. That's why he's been so successful in life. The thing he needs to realize, though, is that for the debates, you do have to take the time to prepare. I believe he thought he could kind of wing it, but especially about halfway through the debate, he was doing well in the first part of it. You really started to see his lack of preparation come through. There were so many great points he could have driven home about black crime and the black unemployment rate and how things have gotten worse under Obama, which he didn't really touch. And he could have done that if he had prepared better and learned some of the material beforehand. So I do really agree with you that he wasn't as prepared, because he does have the high ground on this issue. He is a law and order candidate. He is for the police. And he is for techniques like stop and frisk, which have been proven to stop crime and which is not unconstitutional, unlike what Hillary Clinton has been claiming. And he wasn't as strong on those as he should have been.
I felt like she was somewhat shrewd when she said something to the effect of gun safety as opposed to gun control. And that tells me that whoever's handling her and preparing her was very, very thorough and made sure that even one word was not misspoken in terms of, you know, we all know that she's a great advocate of intruding upon the Second Amendment rights in our country, and yet, you know, not saying gun control straight up, I thought was pretty strategic.
Yeah, she's got a lot of smart people on her side, unfortunately. A lot of liberals, you know, they've studied this stuff. They look at the focus groups. They look at the surveys. They see what people respond well to and don't respond well to. And it is a type of deception. I mean, she is very much against the Second Amendment and wants to restrict guns as much as possible. Again, Trump should have had a good answer on this. The studies, especially from Professor John Lott, for example, at University of Chicago, they do show that when more people have concealed carry, certain types of violent crime do come down. So if you want to make America safe again, especially poor communities, you should support the Second Amendment and support gun rights. You could have driven that home as a way of protecting Americans or protecting poor people when Hillary talked about the, quote, gun safety, as you mentioned. But, again, he didn't come back with that in a strong way. So we do have the upper ground on all these positions. But the question is whether or not Trump will take the time to prepare and whether his team will get him ready. But, yeah, you're exactly right. Hillary has got that. She memorized her lines very well and repeated her memorized lines well. The downside for her is that it does make her look like a politician, but at least she came off as being a little bit more prepared than Trump did.
Well, our guest, John Gibbs, and getting post-debate analysis here on what matters in North Carolina. What's interesting, John, is North Carolina has emerged following a trend over the last two presidential elections as a really important state, a battleground state. We've seen both candidates here repeatedly over the last 6 weeks, almost on a weekly basis. In fact, they were both scheduled to be here in North Carolina again this week. They both canceled because of the events in Charlotte. And I wanted to ask you about yet again another incident involving a African-American individual and the police. And this resulted in great amount of rioting and violence in Charlotte, and just wanted to get kind of an overview of your thoughts on the events in Charlotte over the past week or so.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of run-ins with the Black Lives Matter people on Twitter, and ultimately, not to be harsh, they don't really care about the facts. I mean, they will not wait for the facts to come in before making a judgment. They didn't know anything about whether or not he had a gun. They didn't know anything about his previous history, whether or not he had criminal intentions, what were the police saying to him. They knew nothing about it, but they automatically jumped to the conclusion that something wrong happened. And now that more data is coming out, we're learning just as of yesterday night, he had a stolen gun. It was a stolen gun. He was a felon. He was not allowed to have a gun, so he bought a stolen gun. He spent time in jail in Texas for a few years. He had threatened his wife, and she had a restraining order against him because he attacked her, and he attacked her 8-year-old child. So he's got a history of violence and of confrontations with the police. So now that doesn't describe what happened at this actual incident, but it gives you some background and all that. He's not, you know, you're a Dr. Ben Carson by any stretch of the imagination. And then we have the video come out where the police told him, drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun, repeatedly. But he doesn't drop the gun. He holds the gun, and he keeps walking towards the cops. It's obvious as daylight. I've taken a concealed carry class. Anybody who knows anything about a gun is when the police approach you, you drop that thing, put your hands up, don't move. The police don't know if you're a criminal or not. They've got to assume the worst, or it could be their last day on earth. So they've got to act in order to protect themselves and the public. These seem to me like obvious facts that you and I understand. But I've come to the conclusion increasingly that Black Lives Matter are almost living in a parallel universe where they don't care about the facts, they don't want to know the facts, and they automatically assume that it's an issue of racism against black people whenever incidents like this happen, regardless of the actual facts of the situation.
John, in terms of, and I think that you really hit it squarely on the head with what you just said. There is a disturbing trend, although statistics show that in reality more white Americans have been shot by the police than African Americans. But of course, the media dials in on this and I think tries to fan the flames of racial tension and discord. There was a set of demands issued by some of the rioters and protesters calling for the resignation of the Charlotte mayor and others. And one set of demands called for a defunding of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department with money given to the African-American community there to help with jobs and poverty and that sort of thing. It's clear that there's more to the agenda, wouldn't you agree, than just seeking the so-called justice for an incident?
Yeah, you know, a part of you has to really look at the big picture of this, I'm thinking, and I think about George Soros. So the kind of de facto leader of the Black Lives Matter movement is a guy named D. Ray McKeeson, who is funded by George Soros and who was friends with Obama. He was at the White House just a couple of days ago. He's been there before, too. And I believe this is almost about creating social disorder and chaos in the United States as a way of weakening us. George Soros is not only funding this kind of Black Lives Matter nonsense, he's also funding refugee stuff in Europe. He's trying to get more refugees into the U.S. He's trying to make it easier for people to come here illegally in order to, you know, create division, discord, and put a strain and burden on our society. So that's part of it, too. The other part is, you know, a lot of the black folks out there, for some reason, have been kind of almost brainwashed, for lack of a better word. And when this stuff comes down, you know, police officer shoots black man, they just immediately get inflamed without even taking the chance to say, well, I don't know the facts. I don't know what happened. Who knows? Let's actually wait and see what the details of the situation are. They won't even do that. And if you're talking with them and you try to bring up the facts, they'll just blow up. I mean, I was talking with a lady last night, and I started to say the black murder rate is 8 times higher than the white murder rate. And she just blew up because she didn't like the fact that I was using data and numbers. They just want to get inflamed and mad and blame racism immediately. And if you're not with them, then you must be an Uncle Tom or racist or whatever they want to call you. So, yeah, there's a big picture behind this, and I think someone like George Soros is part of it. President Obama is part of it. His worldview, I believe, is, to say it harshly, anti-white, I believe. He always blames the police. He always blames law enforcement. He always blames racism. The thought would never occur to him that black people have a problem with crime, with broken families inside the community. He won't confront that. So, yeah, there's a lot of big forces at work here, too.
So what is the end game that they envision, John? Is it more government control ultimately? Is that, I mean, what are they trying to accomplish, do you think?
Well, President Obama has been launching these initiatives through the Department of Justice that would have increased federal oversight of local police departments. I believe that's one of their big goals. Local control, local autonomy is a big threat to those who believe in government power, like President Obama and Hillary Clinton, because local communities can say no to the federal government. They can say, F you, we have our own way of doing it, and the Constitution guarantees it. But if they can get more federal control of police departments, that's a way that they can try to micromanage every aspect of society like they would love to do. They've got health care already. They're looking at doing they want to get rid of guns through curtailing the Second Amendment. And I think if they could control the police departments, they'd like to do that too. Free speech. I really believe if you have a Hillary Clinton presidency, things like open debate on Twitter and Facebook will get shut down. They'll claim if you're conservative, that means you support hate speech. Therefore, that's legal. Therefore, you get shut down. It's all part of this picture of removing things like local autonomy that could let people be independent of government control.
Our guest is John Gibbs, political commentator. You can find his work at thefederalist.com. John, my experience with people is that most people are genuinely concerned about the same thing. They want to do well at their jobs. They want to provide for their families. They want to see their kids grow up safe and have, you know, you always want to, the old saying is, you know, you want your kids to do better than you did. And I don't think that that's a white or a black mentality. People are people. And so I think what happens is that this huge broad brush is used to paint the African American community when in reality it's not a large part of the African American community. The folks that live in my neighborhood are no different than me. You know, they take their kids out to the bus stop, they get in their car, they go to work, they come home. You know, everybody's, you know, mowing their yards on the weekend and cooking out. And I mean, I think that somehow the narrative has been has a chokehold on it when it comes to the media and those on the left, that, you know, this is the African-American community, when in reality it may be a small segment of the African-American community, and yet, you know, the whole community is lumped in as this group of people who feels oppressed and who feels violated, and yet nobody I personally know feels that way. They're just trying to get ahead in the world.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. I think most black people, I would say, do not agree with this rioting that was happening. Most of these guys going breaking windows and stealing stuff from stores, they're thugs, and I believe the vast majority of black people would be against that. And the media does like to stir this stuff up. They do like to create this impression of black versus white, you know, there's a racial issue, because it gets them more ratings, it's a more controversial headline. You know, they say if it bleeds, it leads. So it's kind of along those lines. They like to stir this up more than is reality. So I think you bring up a very good point that, yeah, most black folks, like all people, there's not a race to it, do want to have a decent job and have their kids go to good schools. That being said, I still do believe that there are issues in the black community. You know, 90% of black people vote Democratic every election. And a huge part of that is this belief that Republicans are racist. It's not founded in reality. It's not founded in actual facts. But it's this belief that kind of goes unchallenged because, like I said, somehow or another, it's such like an emotional thing for people that when you bring up actual facts, like it was a Democratic Party that supported slavery, the Civil War was in the Democratic Party, Republican Party, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like, he's seen Hillary's America. It's a great film, but he goes into that detail quite a bit. But, you know, facts don't really matter as much for some reason. So that is a big problem, despite the fact that most people are not with these rioters and troublemakers. There still are issues of people being greatly deceived and misinformed.
Well, I think you bring up an excellent point. And one of the things that I think that Donald Trump, I thought was kind of groundbreaking, because you don't normally hear of a Republican candidate, you know, aggressively trying to court the African-American community, which is, as you said, you know, supported the Democratic Party for decades. But he was in Detroit and said, look, what have you got to lose? You know what I mean? Let's, you know, you need to do something different, because I think one of the things that has me scratching my head continually as I look at the history of politics is that the Democratic Party has been able to keep a hold on the African-American community, but the benefits to that community are almost non-existent. And it's like, why do African Americans continue to buy into this notion that the Democrats hold the answer to their futures?
Yeah, you know, I was talking to my dad about this. My dad is, he's a conservative for sure, but he's also a very staunch Democrat, like many black people. Gallup poll has shown that about 30% of black people identify as conservative, even though they vote Democrat. But my dad was saying, the reason I'm a Democrat is because I saw what happened during the 60s. So there's this belief that during the 60s, the Democratic Party was a party of civil rights. Therefore, we got to vote for the Democratic Party. And I was talking with a lady last night. She was a black woman. She was probably in her 60s or so. I said, you know, the problems of 2016 cannot be solved by looking back to 1964. And that's why I just say it every time. You know, we can't be looking back to the past and what happened in the old days. It's a different world. Times have changed. A lot of stuff has changed. But many people are stuck in that mentality. I am a little bit optimistic. I think it's getting better with the younger generation. I see some young black guys on Twitter who are kind of really diverging from this victim mentality and telling their other fellow black folks who are in their 20s, stop complaining about racism all the time. It's really pathetic. What are you, a little kid? Let's step up. Let's get economic growth. Let's get education. Let's start a business. I see increasing voices like that on Twitter, at least. So that's a really good thing to see. I think the younger generation's got some potential. The older generation is a harder nut to crack. They've got this mentality. You know, they want to go back to slavery in 1964 all the time. And how do you argue against that? You're going to get in a time machine? I mean, what can you do with that? But the younger generation seems to be a little bit better.
Well, that certainly is encouraging and perhaps hope for the future. Our guest, John Gibbs. So, John, in terms of getting back to this this presidential campaign, it's been remarkable what Donald Trump has been able to do. Were you surprised a little bit last night that he did not revert back to the really, you know, rambunctious, aggressive debater that he was against his Republican counterparts? I thought he missed a lot of opportunities to hit Hillary when she was talking about the wealthy. And, you know, yeah, here she is with this multi-billion dollar foundation. The emails were basically could have, you know, really jumped on her about that, about Benghazi, about her. You know, she even said, you know, yeah, I spend 11 hours in front of a hearing. And, you know, when you do that, you can talk to me about stamina. And here she was, you know, touting the fact that she was basically the subject of an FBI investigation. And she turned that into a positive. I was really surprised that Trump did not aggressively take her on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, these would have, he had so many home runs that he missed. And again, I think it comes down to a very simple matter of lack of preparation. When I was in my master's program, I took a class in running campaigns, and you drill for debates. I mean, you have someone imitate your opponent. You bring up all the answers they're going to give. You drill your answers. You don't do it just once. You do it repeatedly. I mean, there are so many one-liners you could use against Hillary Clinton. What about the cybersecurity issue? I mean, she brought up cybersecurity. Excuse me, you ran a private server in your home that let hackers have access to classified information. He could have nailed her with that issue when the cybersecurity question was brought up. He didn't talk about immigration once. He didn't even bring up immigration. Terrorism has a huge link to immigration. If we don't let them in, that they won't commit terrorist acts here. It would have been a beautiful point that he could have made, but he didn't make it. Yeah, so there was lots of rich material that he could have had, but he didn't prepare well enough for it, I believe. Again, I said this earlier, Trump is a doer. He's not a talker. That's a good thing in terms of getting things done and executing. We need that in the government. We don't have it right now. The problem is for something like debates, he's always going to come up a little bit short. He's 70 years old. He's set in his ways. He's been very successful. It may be a little bit tough to sit him down and say, we're going to practice now, and you're going to learn your lines. You're going to learn these zingers because we're talking about the future of the country. You got to have the right material for Hillary Clinton. Kellyanne Conway and Steve Bannon, they really need to get him in the corner and his son, Eric Trump, and back him in the corner and say, we are going to practice for the next debate so you can get her back with these liners that you didn't get last time.
Well, perhaps, John, they'll heed your advice, and I think that is good advice. Thank you so much. You're always just one of the most compelling people that I get a chance to talk to, and I appreciate you setting aside time today to join us here again on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. Appreciate it.
All right. Right. Well, always a pleasure to talk to John Gibbs, a really great guest. Also, Dr. David McLennan today. We've really dug into the debate pretty well, and our friends at conservativereview.com, five times that Lester Holt came to Hillary's rescue. He interrupted Trump twice on a question about jobs. He dragged Trump's tax returns into a discussion on tax policy. He brought up the constitutionality of stop and frisk. Speaking of forgetting issues, where were the questions on Clinton Foundation's incestuous relationship to the Clinton State Department, or Benghazi, or Hillary's email server? And questions directed to Trump were more about his personality as opposed to policy. So conservativereview.com, you can check that out there. Always a good resource for conservatives. Really up to date, too. They stay on top of things on a daily basis. So we've had a great show today, and we're going to have another great show tomorrow. You can always find us in the iTunes Store. Download us there. Also in the Google Play Store. You can go to freedomactionnetwork.com also and listen to the podcast anytime you want. Please encourage your friends and family to do so. Text them a link. Let them know that we're here. Remember, as I said at the beginning of the show, it is so very important that you have the information that you need so that you can become conversational and tell the truth to those who would make accusations about the state of North Carolina, whether it's in education or the economy. Thanks for listening to What Matters in North Carolina, and we will look forward to being with you again tomorrow.